From the studios at KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
This morning, we're going to replay the conversation we had back in April 2018 with Alan Stern. He's the New Horizons Pluto mission leader. He had written Chasing New Horizons inside the epic first mission to Pluto, co-written with David Greenspoon. Chasing New Horizons is the story of the men and the women behind this amazing mission, their decades-long commitment and persistence, and the sheer human ingenuity it took to design, build, and fly the mission.
Now, when we spoke with Alan, we also talked to him about the plans for New Horizons' next encounter, a billion miles past Pluto. So Alan's team pointed the New Horizons spacecraft towards Ultima Thule, an icy world on the edge, or shall we say an icy snowman-looking thing, on the edge of our universe. John and I will update you on this exciting rendezvous that took place just 33 minutes into the new year of 2019.
Lynn, I have no idea how 3.5 years ago they could predict exactly when this thing would intercept Thule. It's just
crazy.
Amazing. Yeah. These stories, plus this morning's rover landing on the far side of the moon by the Chinese and three additional moon landings scheduled for 2019 when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Shelley Barris, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. Have you been to our ReStore lately? You will find treasures every visit because we receive new donations of furniture, appliances, and building materials daily. Even better, your purchases support local hardworking families. We are a nonprofit and proud to be a KPCW supporter.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Well, the mission leader from the New Horizons Pluto mission, Alan Stern, is our guest. He joins us to talk about his new book, Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto, which he co-wrote with David Greenspoon. Chasing New Horizons is the story of men and women behind this amazing mission, of their decades-long commitment and persistence, of the political fights within and outside of NASA, of the sheer human ingenuity it took to design, build, and fly the mission, and of the plans for the New Horizons' next encounter, 1 billion miles past Pluto, that'll take place in 2019. Alan Stern, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Now, this is a story of tremendous human achievement, and before we talk about a spacecraft that travels 3 billion miles at 32,000 miles per hour, and all the challenges as it enters the outer part of our solar system, let's go back to 1989. Getting this project funding, I mean, that's one story in itself. Can you talk about that? I mean, the challenges within NASA are huge to get, as you read this, to be able to get a project put together like this.
Yeah, they really are, and it was a series of adventures and misadventures over about a dozen years to get this funded. You know, NASA gets a lot of proposals to do science missions, and there are about 10 times more good ideas than there are dollars to go around to fund things, so it's very selective. You really have to get to the very, very top of the list. And for those of us that were at the very beginning, the group that we called the Plutophiles, or the Pluto Underground, back in the late 80s and then in the 90s, it was a very long effort that ultimately culminated in 2003 in our being ranked the number one priority. But it took an enormous amount of work and stamina and persistence, And I have to give those people credit. They stuck with it and made a dream come true.
Traditional models of our solar system are very plain, and they show the planets sort of stacked up against each other, revolving around the sun. Of course, that's not really accurate, because Pluto is, for an example, so much further away than the other planets. And I think you did a good job in the book of giving us an idea of just how far it is. If the Earth were the size of a basketball, the sun, 93 million miles away from Earth, would be 5.5 miles away. Pluto would be over 220 miles away. Compared to the universe, the solar system is very small, but the solar system itself, for us, as we explore it, seems to be pretty big.
It's vast. It's vast beyond human comprehension. You know, our spacecraft is the fastest spacecraft ever launched, and it traveled so fast that whereas Apollo missions with Apollo moon landing crews launched at 25,000 miles an hour and took 3 days to reach the moon at that speed, New Horizons reached the orbit of the moon in 9 hours flat, and still it took us 9.5 years to cross the solar system at that blinding speed. It's just incredible how big the solar system is and how far away Pluto is.
Alan, a few minutes ago you talked about being a plutophile, and I'm wondering what makes a plutophile versus, you know, someone who was interested more in NASA's Voyager missions to Uranus and Neptune.
That's a great question, and I have to say, to be honest, almost everybody that I have ever run into that's been involved in this mission, who's a scientist, has multiple scientific interests. My own interests range from research about the Earth's moon and the Earth's upper atmosphere all the way out to the Kuiper Belt where Pluto orbits. And I'm pretty typical of the scientists on the team. But, you know, for those of us who call ourselves plutophiles, it was really about a couple of things. First, all the clues that we were getting from telescopic surveys and things like that were telling us that Pluto was really a scientific wonderland. And so that's a pretty strong incentive when you want to make your career exciting and you want to make discoveries to go to a place like that. But second, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when space exploration was brand new, one of the most prized things a scientist could do to be on a first mission to an unexplored planet, first to Mars, first to Venus, first to Jupiter, what have you. By the time our generation came along, you know, late 80s, early 90s, all those had been done, from Mercury all the way to Neptune. And Pluto was kind of the last train to Clarksville, the last unexplored planet. Now we know there are a lot more like Pluto farther out in the Kuiper Belt, but still, the motivation for us was to be a part of something that there was no other opportunity to do, to be on a first mission to a brand new place and to be explorers. And it was a very strong motivation, and it sustained us through all those difficult times getting this funded and built and flown across the solar system.
Mm. In your conversations with lay people and friends and family and people who were outside but knew about your exploration of the first mission, what were the, you know, what were the myths that people held about Pluto that you knew, boy, you know, when we achieve this exploration, boy, we are going to come back with this kind of information to show the world?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I would categorize as a myth was that people who didn't really know the science, and of course, you know, if you're not in the area, you're not going to know it, but I think a lot of people just thought it would be a boring ice ball. And of course, like I said, it did turn out to be a scientific wonderland with an atmosphere and clouds and hazes and ground fogs and a system of 5 satellites and glaciers that are in flow and an ocean on the inside, complicated geology, volcanoes and soaring mountains. And it just turned out to be spectacular.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Alan Stern, who's the principal investigator, the person responsible for the entire program that went and explored Pluto, a flyby of Pluto. He co-wrote Chasing New Horizons inside the epic first mission to Pluto with David Greenspoon. Tell us about that one big moment that that you talk about in the book on July 14th in 2015, when you're probably exhausted from all of the things you had to do for the flyby and all the media that was there, and you viewed a package that was sent by New Horizons of fresh pictures, and you had quite a reaction to that. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, thanks for asking about that, and all these stories and the things we're talking about are brought out in the book. You know, when we got that first detailed picture that showed how spectacularly beautiful and how strong the personality of Pluto was, with all these varied terrains, this alien world that no one had ever seen before, the size of basically North America. The special moment for me was seeing my team, all these people who had worked on this, one shot, it's either going to work or it doesn't, scientific expedition. People who'd worked on this in many cases for 15 or 20 years, to see the reaction, the emotion on their faces to how beautiful it was, and to the fact that this meant we'd succeeded. After all this working in anonymity for all these years, nights and weekends, 52 weeks a year, very small team, and then when the first detailed images came to the ground and people saw it, there were tears and hugs, and it was so rewarding to just see people achieve this thing that they'd wanted for so much of their careers.
And your proposal started in 1989. The liftoff was in 2006. You got there in 2015. From 1989, let's say 26 years, you are, I think, 10 days away from the flyby. So we're talking about the example that you just talked about was a very big high for you. And now we'll talk about a low. 10 days before the flyby, the spacecraft stopped communicating with you.
Yeah, it was heart-stopping. Nothing like that's ever supposed to ever happen in any space mission. And in the few cases that I had recalled where spacecraft stopped communicating, usually that was game over. For example, a spacecraft called Mars Observer stopped communicating 4 days before arriving at Mars, and it had blown up. And I was sitting in my office near Mission Control. We were 10 days from culminating this 26-year effort. Spacecraft had performed almost flawlessly for the entire journey across the solar system. And it's a Saturday. It's July 4th. Most people are taking the day off. It's a holiday. I get a phone call from the project manager, and he says to me words that I almost couldn't believe. He said, "Alan, we've lost contact with a spacecraft." Mm. And if you've ever seen that movie Apollo 13 and how Mission Control swung into action and round-the-clock work to save that crew, it was something very similar, because we knew the spacecraft was barreling down on, you know, it was going to be at Pluto in 10 days. And we had to regain contact and find out what was wrong and fix what was wrong and get it back on track to start taking all the data, because in almost no time at all, this would be over. And I tell you, our Mission Control and engineering team, what they did was heroic. And people were literally camped out, sleeping on desks and, on the floor 24/7 until we got the problem fixed. And I think they did about 6 months worth of work in a matter of 4 days or so to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. It turned out the spacecraft was fine, and there had been a programming mistake in the way that we had sent some instructions to it. We were able to fix that problem and get all the flight plans back up on the spacecraft, all the computer files. But it was harrowing. And I think the book tells that story in a really interesting way. I hope somebody makes a movie out of it.
It's, as you speak about it, it sounds like a movie, and it's riveting. Well, what a victory then when it finally came back online and you had communication again just in the nick of time. Can you take us through some of the visuals? You know, you talked about oceans and glacial flows and clouds and ground fog and volcanoes. maybe start by talking about the water on Pluto.
Sure. Well, you know, water is a very common constructional material in the outer solar system. Water ice represents, in the outer solar system, what rock does here on Earth. It's very common in the crusts of planets and satellites out there. And in Pluto's case, we had looked, and using a technique called spectroscopy, never found water ice on Pluto's surface from Earth or the Hubble Space Telescope or anything like that. Pluto's surface is covered in much more exotic materials, condensed methane, that's natural gas, condensed nitrogen and carbon monoxide. But when the spacecraft got there and could see in much more detail, we found these tall soaring mountains as tall as the Rockies. And that told us that Pluto's crust was made of water ice because the nitrogen and carbon monoxide and other things that we see on the surface, like methane, just aren't strong enough to build mountains out of. If you built a mountain out of one of those things, it would slump under its own weight because they're weak. It's like building a skyscraper out of tissue paper. It wouldn't work. It would collapse. But water ice is very strong, like rock. And so the tall mountains told us that there was probably water ice under this veneer of all these exotic frosts. And then as we got close, the spectrometers on board the spacecraft could see in much more detail, of course, than we could from Earth. And we could see bare patches where water ice was sticking out. For example, maybe places that were windswept and the frosty veneer had been swept off. And that confirmed for us that Pluto's entire crust is made of water ice. And down below, we have evidence that that water actually melts and becomes a liquid and forms a global ocean inside the planet.
Wow. That's fantastic. So... As you're collecting data along with, no doubt, many, many different scientists, if you take apart the team that was gathering data, looking at the information that you were bringing off of Pluto, you know, talk about some of those different sciences that were gathering data.
Well, planetary science is a very interdisciplinary field with people, who study atmospheres and satellites and how things are made, the origins of the world, the geology, the geophysics, and all of that is a part of what we found at Pluto. And fortunately, we had experts in all those things, not in all the sub-areas. It turned out, for example, our geology team didn't have any glaciologists on it because we didn't expect to find glaciers, but we actually found glaciers ranging over hundreds and hundreds of miles and flowing out of mountains, down valleys, and even subducting at the edges back underground. So we ended up having to hire some glaciologists after the flyby just to add that kind of expertise because it was a complete discovery.
Yeah. We enjoy the warmth of the sun, again, 93 million miles away from the Earth. Again, Pluto is over 3 billion miles. Not a lot of light out there. Was that one of the principal, or was that one of the driving pieces behind having plutonium, having this nuclear powered?
Yeah. So at Pluto, the sunlight is 1,000 times dimmer than it is in broad daylight on the Earth. And temperatures are very cold. And the way that most spacecraft are powered, which is with solar power, just doesn't work. The sunlight's too faint and the conditions are too cold. So for all the missions that NASA has flown out to the frontier of the solar system, we've used nuclear power. And New Horizons was no different in that. We actually used a spare nuclear power generator fueled with plutonium, the element that was named for the planet Pluto. But our spare was left over from some previous NASA programs to study Jupiter and Saturn. And so we had it fueled up by the Department of Energy and, of course, bolted onto the spacecraft. And that nuclear battery's got enough power not just to take us across the solar system and explore Pluto, but to go on as we are. Our next flyby is going to take place on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day this year, coming up at the end of the year, a billion miles beyond Pluto. And we have enough power to run that spacecraft out into the 2030s, thanks to that nuclear power generator.
Oh, that's great. I wanted to ask you about the future of of spaceflight for these unmanned spacecraft. Bill Nye's organization, I think it was about a year and a half ago, put up a space sail that they were going to be testing. And it's a sail that would, I don't believe it picks up photons of light. I think it picks up maybe the solar wind. Is that a viable source of power for future spacecraft?
Well, those sails, called solar sails, reflect the sunlight and use that to create a very gentle but persistent thrust so that it's almost like, think of a car that didn't need a fuel tank and have an infinite fuel tank because it runs on sunlight. And so that technology is not to power the spacecraft, but to help change its trajectory. And the Planetary Society, which Bill Nye runs, is really pioneering that with some flight testers. They're going to do another one this year. And once that technology is perfected, I think for both robotic and human missions, it has just enormous potential to open up new ways to explore the solar system. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of other exciting things going on. I think the 21st century is really where Star Trek begins in terms of space exploration. Fasten your seatbelts, hold on to your hats, because the technologies that are coming online in the commercial sector as well as in the government sector are just like something out of a storybook, science fiction.
That's so great. So what's the future for New Horizons?
And start preparing for this flyby. First flyby activities begin in August. We are flying to a small, ancient building block of planets like Pluto, something that's only about 20 miles across. Might be a binary, a double object. It might even have moons orbiting that double. And we're really looking forward to using this flyby. It's going to be the farthest exploration in the history of humankind. We're really looking forward to this flyby teaching us about how small planets like Pluto on the frontier of the solar system were built. And then we're going to go on farther and farther out into the Kuiper Belt and explore using the telescopes and plasma sensors and so forth on board the spacecraft for years and years to come. New Horizons is perfectly healthy and has the power and the fuel to operate for probably 20 more years.
Dr. Alan Stern, he's the principal investigator for the New Horizons spacecraft that did the spectacular flyby of Pluto. He and David Greenspoon have written a book, Chasing New Horizons. It's available on May 1st. Dr. Stern, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me here. It's been a pleasure.
And we are back live. That, again, was a tape conversation we had with Alan Stern at the end of April of 2018 to learn about the entire Pluto project, but more importantly, because it's so timely, the rendezvous with Ultima Thule, which happened 33 minutes into the new year. So since leaving Pluto 3.5 years ago, New Horizons spacecraft was pointed 34,000 miles an hour towards Ultima Thule, which is about 4.1 billion miles from Earth, and intercepted that icy world 33 minutes into the new world. Pretty cool, huh?
It is pretty cool. And we tried to get Alan Stern back on Cool Science Radio today, but, you know, with that happening 33 minutes into the new year, so exciting. He's been doing nonstop news conferences and just wasn't able to make it. But it's pretty exciting. New Horizons team actually pulling this off, executing it absolutely flawlessly as planned, at the moment planned. How do they do it? It's great.
How do you calculate? Can you imagine all the math that would go into that to be able to put that intercept together? And because Ultima Thule is considerably smaller than Pluto, they had to point the spacecraft so that it would fly by four times closer than when they got to Pluto. So it was pretty tricky. And of course, you have that time. I mean, it's communicating with us at the speed of light, the communication system. But if it's 4.1 billion miles away, it took 6 hours for a message to travel back to us. So when they pointed the spacecraft at Ultima Thule and they were looking to see if they actually made the rendezvous. They had to wait 6 hours because the spacecraft was out of communication, and it took that long to be able to send its first picture and to basically say, hey, I'm okay, we hit the spot where we want it to.
It's pretty interesting when you think of all the technology that goes into this, all the instrumentation, and yet during the flyby, because basically New Horizons turned its antenna towards Ultima Thule to gather the observation and the data, it was turning the antenna away from home. So that's why it was out of communication. And once it sent that confirmation that it had survived the flyby at a distance of about 2,200 miles away from it, Ultima Thule, it was a lot of celebration around the room at NASA.
Yeah.
And especially for our previous guest, Alan Stern, who's worked on this so intimately for so many years. So Ultima Thule, this is something that I think is pretty cool. You know, there are all these scientists down buried in their work, but they come out and they actually elicit suggestions from the public on what you would call this thing that we now know looks like a snowman with a little globe on top and a bigger globe on the bottom. And 34,000 suggestions from the public they took, and they decided to call it Ultima Thule. Thule, what it means is beyond the borders of the known world.
Well, it's the furthest we've been able to explore a new world. It's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. It is. Hey, let's take a short underwriting break and then come back and let's talk about some lunar exploration that's taking place right now. In fact, right now, as in today, what's today? January 3rd.
January 3rd.
2019 by those Chinese. Stay with us.
One out of every three adults over the age of 20 have high blood pressure. Nearly 20% don't even know they have it because typically there are no symptoms. I'm Dr. Anna Catino, a cardiologist at University of Utah Health's Redstone Clinic. The best way to know if you have high blood pressure is to have it checked. Left unchecked, you put yourself at higher risk of heart attack and stroke. For information or an appointment, visit heart.uofuhealth.org. University of Utah Health is a nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Well, I tell you what, it's going to be an exciting year for space exploration, specifically for taking a peek at our old friend, the moon. There are four landings that are anticipated throughout the year of 2019. The first one, the Chang'e 4, was a spacecraft that the Chinese sent up in December with a rover. And they have landed that rover on the far side of the moon this morning. It's just landed, and it's transmitted some pictures back already. It's not 4.1 billion miles away. I think the moon's about 235,000 miles from here. So it's pretty quick to get those pictures back. We're getting pictures right now, and it's pretty exciting. You can certainly go online and take a peek at this.
Lots of great photos of the moon. And I'm wondering if, for some reason, our technology, it looks unlike the moon has looked to us in previous photos, with a lot more craters and undulations and topography. I wonder if that's just the advancement in our technology of being able to photograph it.
Yeah, I think we need to get some more pictures and to hear about more about this. We have looked at the backside of the moon, the far side of the moon, what is also known as the dark side of the moon, before. And I guess basically the moon revolves at the same rate so as Earth, so we are always looking at the same side of the moon. So that's why when we look at the moon, these craters are so familiar to us. This will be on the dark side of the moon. Doesn't mean it's dark. The far side of the moon, also known as the dark side of the moon, gets as much sun as the near side that faces Earth. It's just that they call it the dark side of the moon.
And
it actually gets a lot of sun.
And did you mention it's the first time a spacecraft craft has ever landed on that far side.
Yeah.
Pretty fascinating. And the whole reason that China is, I mean, this mission is largely scientific, but the whole idea behind why China is doing it now is because there's plans very soon to be sending astronauts back. So it's kind of like reliving the Apollo days all over again. But for China, and I don't know why that is. Do you know?
Well, I know that China has really beefed up their program and they want to be a major player. There have only been two countries that have made it to the moon, and that's us and the Soviet Union. Actually, Chang'e 3 was a rover that the Chinese put up on the near side of the moon, and that stopped operating after about 900 days for some reason. But they've been there before. But as you said, this is the first time to the far side of the moon. The significance of that is the Earth is pretty noisy. There are things coming out of the Earth like episodes of Cool Science Radio, and that
just clog up the space.
It just clogs up everything. So being on the far side of the moon, they can set their instrumentation packages up, and they can have a better look at the cosmos, be able to look at solar weather, keep their eye on our friend the sun, and all these other different things that they can now do being on that far side. And being where they are, they cannot easily communicate back to Earth. So earlier in 2018, the Chinese put up a satellite, a communication satellite, so that the rover on the far side could beam data from the instrumentation packages to the satellite, which would then relay it to the Blue Marble.
Mm, that's great. So that's China's, we don't know if we're pronouncing it right, but Chang'e 4 mission. And then let's talk about the Israeli company that is due in February for a lunar landing.
Well, SpaceIL is scheduled, that's from Israel, is scheduled to send a land rover to the moon in February. It was one of the original four finalists in Google's Lunar X Prize, but the prize went unclaimed when none of the companies were able to meet the launch deadline of March 31st, 2018.
But if this Israeli mission succeeds, it would make that country, as you mentioned before, you said Russia, U.S., now China, and then the fourth would be Israel to complete a soft landing on the moon.
And back to the roller derby competition. Coming up on the outside rail is India. Here's the problem. India may launch Chandrayaan-2, the nation's first moon lander and rover, as soon as late January, scooping that coveted fourth position from Israel. India could pick that up, and then Israel would come in fifth. And Israel's not happy with that, so they are trying to accelerate their they're trying to compact their little schedule to get there first. But so here are the moon landings again. The one this morning by the Chinese, Chang'e 4. Israel SpaceIL, they're scheduled to send a lander in February. Israel could get beaten by India, who may launch as soon as January. And then to get to higher level confusion, the Chinese once again are going to be out there with Chang'e 5, which would be later in 2019. And this is one that would collect samples and then later return to Earth for our study.
We're sort of doing a tour of the lunar surface and all the countries that are making a play for sending astronauts and just sending spacecraft, as China did this morning, landing a spacecraft on the moon just this morning.
If you're scoring this from home, China's got their first one, Chang'e 4, which landed this morning. The rover is on the far side of the moon. The Israelis are trying to get something going for February. India is trying to accelerate their plan so they can beat Israel to the moon. And then China will be back later in 2019. And Lynn, I have to ask the question. I mean, President Kennedy asked the country back in the early 60s to put a stake in the ground and to land a man on the moon by the end of that decade, which would be sometime in 1969. And it's kind of a coincidence that there's all this activity surrounding the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8, which was when we sent Commander James Lovell, Frank Borman, to the moon. They circled the moon. They mm-hmm. took that iconic picture. It's the most recognized picture on the planet, in the world, of the Earth rising with the moon in the foreground. And it's just an extraordinary picture that was on New Year's, Christmas Eve of 1968, December 21st, or December 24th. And then Apollo 11, which is when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon, that was July 20th, 1969. So that's the 50-year anniversary, and there's all this activity to get to the moon again.
Well, activity and competition. And I just want to say something. I think I've told you this a couple of times, a story. I think it was This American Life podcast that I heard the strangest interview with Frank Borman, who, again, was one of the astronauts on Apollo 8. I think it was an episode of This American Life in which they were giving unexpected things that you would hear.
Yeah.
So this unexpected thing was that Frank Borman, who is now in his 90s and lives in Montana, it wasn't so much about the thrill of traveling to the moon and being an astronaut. For him, it was about beating the Russians. He was incredibly patriotic.
Of course.
And he was very nonplussed about being at the moon. He just wanted to come home and be with his family. And there he was. And they took this, you know, the photograph that we remember the most and the most impactful, gorgeous photograph. And he was sort of nonchalant about it, just saying, I was there and I did it and it was fine, but I just wanted to be with my family. We were there during Christmas. It was really a notable interview. But again, it was because of his competitive spirit that he wanted to beat Russia. So
he was a military flyboy. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fast forward to 2019, and it's all about this competition again.
We're back in it.
Yeah.
Hey, 2019, we have other things to talk about other than the moon, is going to be a pretty good year for meteor showers. Do you want to tell us about that?
Meteor showers. Yes, this is interesting. I often miss those in the summer. I don't know why, but if you are one of those that miss some pretty heavy meteor showers last August with the Perseids, and the Geminids in December, you can see the Quadrantids in January. What are the dates here? You've got them here.
Well, somewhere. The peak will be tonight and tomorrow night if we have clear skies. And this one's a little different. It's unusual because this meteor shower originates from an asteroid that broke up many, many years ago, and we're now passing through the fragments.
So these tend to be fainter with fewer streaks in the sky, but I do believe it's supposed to be clear tonight. So if you're out there, there are more hours of darkness, and so your chances of seeing meteor showers at like 8:30 p.m. instead of in the middle of the night are greater. So they are active now. Again, the peak will be tonight and tomorrow. And until about January 12th, you can see those meteor showers, the Quadrantids.
Yeah. Space Shuttle Atlantis was retired in 2011. So we have not gone to space. We have not put a man in space since then. We've been relying on a woman. We've been relying on Russia and their Soyuz capsules to make the journeys back and forth from the International Space Station. But things are heating up again for 2019, a very critical year, where all of the private companies will be hopefully doing some final tests and putting men and women back into space.
That's right. So SpaceX, as we know, very active with their private space program. And Boeing, those two companies have both built new capsules to carry crews for NASA and other space agencies. So the SpaceX's capsule is called the Dragon.
The Dragon.
The Dragon. And it's scheduled for its first uncrewed, so unmanned, test launch on January 17th. And if that succeeds, a test launch could, with crew aboard, follow in June.
How about Boeing Starliner? That will fly no crew in March and followed by a test carrying astronauts in August. Falcon Heavy, of course, was tested by SpaceX last year successfully. And on the day of that test, Elon Musk said, I've got a new rocket. It's the biggest rocket ever been made. It's called BFR. First letter is for big, and the last one's for rocket. And use your imaginations on the middle letter. But that is going to be lined up for testing soon.
Exciting
they just got the go-ahead for the test on that.
I think one of the most the times that I've been most impacted by visions of what's going on in space was actually when the Falcon Heavy was returned to the launch pad. Was that a year ago, a year and a half ago?
Oh,
that was the most incredible feat of physics I have ever seen.
And everybody that I talked to that has seen that YouTube video was really affected by it. I mean, that was Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
That was like an old Flash Gordon movie of this of these two rockets landing side by side simultaneously.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen that, go to the YouTube and check it out.
Falcon Heavy.